You're listening to a podcast produced by the Jackson School of International Studies, the Center for West European Studies, and the European Union Center at the University of Washington. This and other podcasts can be found on iTunes and SoundCloud. For more information, visit us at jsis.washington.edu/EU West Europe.
Welcome, everybody. My name is Sabine Lang. I'm a professor of European and International Studies at the Henry M. Jackson School of International Studies here at the University of Washington, where I also direct the Center for West European Studies, which is an Erasmus-funded Jean Monnet Center of Excellence of the European Union. I would like to welcome all of you to this first talk this academic year for our Talking Gender in Europe and the EU series. We use this forum generally to bring together speakers for a very loosely threaded conversation on the state of gender equality in the European Union, its member states, and in Europe more generally. Before we get started now, let me address a few housekeeping details. This, you've noticed this by now, this is a Zoom webinar, and that means as an audience, nobody can hear and see you. I'm asking you to put your questions while our speaker is talking or afterwards, whenever the impulse strikes you, into the Q&A that you see at the lower end of your screen. The format we choose for these talks is always the same. We have about a 30-minute plus minus lecture by our speaker. During that lecture, as I said, please type in questions, and then we will afterwards have a discussion and try to answer as many of the inputs that we see on the screen. As always, this forum would not be possible without a range of speakers and without a range of sponsors that we're having. So the speakers you will have noticed for this year in the online advert we sent around. The sponsors that I would like to point out particularly is the European Union, the Jean Monnet Center, and the chair for civil society inclusion and diversity that I hold, the Center for West European Studies, and the Jackson School here at UW. Finally, a big thanks to our organizers, CWES Managing Director Phil Lyon and Program Coordinator Emma Delapree, who is today in charge of making this a smooth event. Learning more about the state of affairs in Europe more broadly today in terms of gender equality will take us to Turkey. We have with us Professor Ayşe Dursun from the University of Vienna, and she will talk with us about organized Muslim women in Turkey, applying an intersectional approach to what it means in Turkey today to build women's coalition. Her talk today is based on a monograph that she published last year with Palgrave Macmillan, and I'll just hold it up quickly. I like the cover a lot. It's a great book. Professor Dursun is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Vienna, and her research focuses on gender equality politics, on social reproduction and care, as well as on women's movements and migration. She's also a steering committee member of the ECPR, the European Consortium for Political Research Standing Group on Gender and Politics. And I know that she wears many administrative hats in her department at the University of Vienna, and intellectual hats in our conversation. So Ayşe, thanks very much for making time for us today. We are excited to have you with us because it's also late in Europe. It is 9 p.m. and I just learned that we're getting your input today from Madrid. So we hope you have a bit more sun than we do in the Pacific Northwest. But with this, I'd like to turn this over to you and look forward to a wonderful talk and discussion. Thank you.
Sabine, thank you so much for this kind introduction. And also thank you so much for having me today to all the participants. Thank you very much for coming, for your time. I look forward to the discussion that we will be having after what I hope won't be a talk not longer than 30, maximum 40 minutes. I will try to make sure of that. So without losing any time, I would like to proceed with my slides. As Sabine just mentioned, today's talk will be based on a book that I published last year, which explores the politics of organized Muslim women in Turkey. By politics, I very broadly mean the political discourses, agendas, strategies, and organizational forms pursued by politically active Muslim women within the civil society. Politics, in the sense, also includes the alliances and coalitions these women built with other Muslim women or with other social movements to achieve common political goals. The context of the research is contemporary Turkey, which is highly fragmented and dynamic and at the same time characterized by the amalgamation of neoliberalism and religious conservatism. Under the rule of the Islamically oriented AKP, which has been in power in more than two decades now. The supporting pillar of this regime is a specific mode of patriarchy, which has been described as neoliberal conservative, and it aligns seemingly contradictory agendas by, on one hand, promoting women's integration into the now flexible labor market with curtailed rights and securities, and on the other hand, confining women to the private sphere to maintain, I quote, the normalized wifehood and motherhood roles.
So Aisha, sorry that I'm coming in from the off, but we cannot see your PowerPoint.
I'm sorry for that. Did I at any point, is it because of the... because of the Zoom window?
You would need to share your screen, I think, if you have it on your laptop.
I think, okay. Is it better now?
Yes, great.
Beautiful. You see, I was afraid something looked different than before, but I wasn't aware that I had switched to sharing another window.
Totally fine. Now we're good. Thank you.
Okay, excellent. So sorry for the inconvenience, but as I was saying, I take the socially constructed and historically specific mode of patriarchy as the broader canvas against which I study women's coalitions. So against this broader political background, I ask which factors impact organized Muslim women's political capacity and willingness to build coalitions with other, say, feminist, socialist, Kurdish women who are also politically active or organized. Before I proceed with the next slides, I would like to ask and answer one question that seems important, namely, why do coalitions matter in the first place? Why study them? Social movement research provides ample evidence that building coalitions within a movement as well as across movements can improve activists' prospects for achieving a common political goal, especially when faced with a political opportunity or a threat. The idea for my doctoral project, from which this book stems and on which my talk today draws, came up in the early 2010s when a reform-friendly political atmosphere oriented towards democratization and EU membership was sweeping Turkey under the then newly elected AKP. In the early 2000s, women had achieved important legal reforms to the civil code and the penal code by building broad cross-movement coalitions. Although feminist, socialist, and Kurdish women were already used to pursuing coalition politics and politics of solidarity, despite political differences and contradictions, Muslim women, until then known for their political struggle towards the lift of the headscarf bans, were relative newcomers to such politics. I saw, and they still see, great potential in such broad-based women's coalitions to transform and potentially overcome patriarchal gender relations. Before I proceed to provide a brief definition of two basic terms that I use throughout the book, namely women's movement and organized Muslim women, let me briefly elaborate on three main theoretical assumptions that serve to embed my research on women's movements and coalitions in a broader feminist social theory framework. So the first assumption draws on a very long and rich tradition of Black feminist thought and maintains that societies are structured along socially constructed, historically specific, and interlocking systems of oppression. One such distinct system of oppression is patriarchy, and that is, and it is of key relevance for women's lives, and is at the same time always permeated by other systems of oppression, such as racism or class exploitation. And only if we conceptualize patriarchy in intersectional terms, as Black feminists and feminists of color have been doing, can we grasp that patriarchy distributes power unevenly, not only between men and women, but also among women. This is not a side effect, but a main function of patriarchy to produce difference among women. While all women are disadvantaged based on their gender, the social positions of some of them are relatively improved, for example, by their whiteness, privileged class positions, or normative sexualities. Thirdly, now conceptualized in intersectional terms, patriarchy shapes women's experiences, identities, but also politics and political relations with each other, which also brings me to women's movements and coalitions. In order to define women's movements, I borrow from political scientist Joyce Altshorn, who defines a woman's movement as both ideas, aspirations, and identities developed from gender consciousness, and as actors who articulate these ideas and aspirations in public. According to this, women's movements act to advance what they see as women's interests. So feminist movements, which are a subset of the total population of women's movements, hold that there is something wrong with the status of women and challenge gender hierarchies and women's subordination. So according to this very basic definition, not all women's movements are feminist movements. Some women's movements can be even anti-feminist, but all feminist movements are women's movements. So based on these theoretical or conceptual considerations, I understand an organized Muslim woman as any woman's movement actor, both collective and individual, who organizes formally or informally with direct or indirect reference to gender, who or where, if you're talking about an organization, for example, what may be feminist or an anti-feminist. So they do not display, not necessarily any common ideological or organizational characteristics, but do bring together gender issues and religion in their politics. Now, here is a very brief introduction, very brief overview on the origins and historical origins and evolution of a contentious women's movement, namely the pro-headscarf movement. Many organized women have become politically active or politicized in this pro-headscarf movement, which is true especially for the older generation Muslim women. But I will talk about that some more in the following slides. But first of all, most accounts on Muslim women start with the introduction of the first headscarf bans in the early 80s at school, in the public service, and at universities, which of course, met with a response. And what followed were protests by headscarved women through hunger strikes, sit-ins, and petitions. The headscarf bans were lifted and reintroduced in a back-and-forth fashion before being reintroduced again in the late 1990s. This is when, again, Muslim women affected by the bans formed solidarity groups and associations. The women engaged in this form of politics who have advocated for the lift of the headscarf bans and who were wearing headscarves in the first place were commonly referred as Islamist women to underline the counter-hegemonic character of the broader Islamist women of which they were a part. But things have started changing with the coming into power of AKP, the pro-Islamic AKP, in 2002, and the lift of the headscarf bans throughout the 2010s. With AKP in power, Islamist actors consolidated themselves within state institutions. Islamic symbols, discourses, policies became normal, so they are increasingly becoming the norm. So in this book, I prefer the more neutral Muslim women phrase, which underlines the now hegemonic character of the formerly counter-hegemonic Islamist actors and their discourses. So as these brief elaborations make clear, it is difficult, if not impossible, to talk about the Muslim women's movement as today they display important or even irreconcilable differences with regard to their political positions, agendas, but also politics in general, as the next slides will demonstrate. But this has not always been the case, at least not to the same extent. Now, here is a brief overview of my sample. The data is based on 28 in-depth semi-structured interviews conducted with 28 selected Muslim women who were formerly or still at the time of the interview active in various associations, foundations, or other informal organizations in Turkey. Their ages ranged between the 20s and the 50s. Most women in their 30s or older were married and or had children. Most of them lived in big cities, although many of them were born, grew up, or spent considerable amount of time in different Anatolian cities. They either attended secular track schools or religious vocational Imam Hatip schools. Most of them pursued or already held academic degrees, be it BA, MA, or PhD, in various disciplines such as theology, philosophy, psychology, sociology of religion, political science, gender studies, law, computer engineering, and medicine. They were either homemakers, worked in regular paid jobs, or for NGOs on a voluntary or paid basis. They had in common being religious women, but differed considerably with respect to how they interpreted and practiced religion. So unsurprisingly, maybe, their take on other political issues differed too, be it on gender equality and women's rights, or redistributive matters, or the Kurdish issue, their stance on Gezi Park protests, AKP, and others. Now I would like to, you know, start talking about the empirical findings, and I would like to talk about first the issue areas, that is the areas that organized Muslim women in my sample covered in their politics or addressed in their collective politics. This is probably not a complete list, or this list doesn't exhaust all the issue areas currently addressed by organized Muslim women, but I am confident that it does cover main or major issue areas. I think it is important that we take a minute to talk about the issue areas that organized Muslim women tackle currently, because they provide important clues as to their capacities and willingness to build or not to build women's coalitions with other organized activists or organized women. So unsurprisingly, one issue area or one issue that I could observe with most of the women in my sample was the headscarf issue. So they started out as the protagonists of a contentious movement, namely the pro-headscarf movement in the 1970s and 80s, and challenged the institutions and the narratives of the modern republic by covering their heads to symbolize a religious lifestyle, but more importantly, a different, namely Islamic, vision of the society and of the modern Turkish women at large. That was different than what was originally envisioned by the secularist founding fathers. As the headscarf bans were loosened and finally lifted under the AKP rule, the political and societal basis for the pro-headscarf movement has, maybe unsurprisingly so, has vanished. Muslim women who were in their 30s or older were generally politicized by the headscarf bans, which they had faced as university students or public servants, whereas younger generation Muslim women in their 20s were less so, since they grew up under an Islamically oriented government. One Muslim woman who could, just to name an example, who could attain her degree in medicine only with a major delay due to the headscarf bans, was active in an association which had formerly advocated for the lift of the headscarf bans, which in the meantime has become active, inactive, sorry. And another Muslim woman whom I talked to name one last example, who is at the same time a well-known Muslim women's rights activist. She was active in an association and mentioned during our interview that now that the headscarf bans are lifted, she and her friends can finally devote their attention to other more important women's issues. Secondly, I could observe that a major line of conflict between Muslim women was between those who defended gender equality in their politics and those who defended gender justice. So all Muslim women whom I talked to could be assigned to either one of these two camps. So they were either pro-gender equality or pro-gender justice. Feminist Muslim women worked with the feminist concept of gender equality to address gendered issues ranging from division of labor to violence. They thought that there is something fundamentally wrong with the status of women in the society, and that women's status can only be improved by dismantling gender inequality. Conservative women, on the contrary, opposed to the feminist concept of gender equality and instead proposed to work with the religiously informed concept of gender justice, which maintains that sexes cannot, so men and women, thought in a binary way, cannot be equal, for they are ontologically, that is the argument, for they are ontologically different, although they are of the same value. The gender justice camp is successful in aligning with AKP's growing hostility vis-a-vis the feminist movement and its demands, and also serves to provide sort of a democratic legitimacy for the regime by feigning civil societal participation and consensus. I move on to the third major issue area that I could observe among the organized Muslim women that I talk to, and that is violence. The gender equality versus gender justice divide was mirrored in the politics of Muslim women who directly or indirectly tackle violence against women. Here, I identified three different groups of Muslim women whom I labeled as fighters, moderates, and deniers. I think the names are quite self-explanatory, but let me maybe briefly go into detail. Fighters situate the roots of violence in social relations, and more specifically in asymmetrical relations of power between men and women. Therefore, they believe that gender-based violence can be eliminated by dismantling relations of inequality. They demand, for example, that municipalities fulfill their legal obligation to open women's shelters. And they also demand binding standards for service provision in shelters, including qualified psychological support and professional training. They launched an online petition to create publicity for women's shelters in the run-up to the 2004 local elections, and advertised their campaign on the streets on a conservative district in Istanbul, which has historically been a stronghold for Islamist parties. One of the women involved in this campaign, Betül, told me an anecdote that some men approached the activists and asked whether splitting the families was what they wanted. Betül, whose friends had reported such incidents, explained that, I quote Betül, "A woman going to a woman's shelter after having been battered is considered scattering the nest, that is the home, because somehow the woman must forgive and come back to the husband or family." Betül also pointed to the sexist attitude of the judges and prosecutors, which shaped the course of ex post legal proceedings. Another interviewee, Aslı, whom I also considered a fighter like Betül, noted that male perpetrators are often granted good conduct abatement or abatement of unjust provocation, and women who, for example, injure a man while defending themselves are denied acquittal. And this is a political position that is very similar, if not identical, to that of autonomous feminists in Turkey. Beyond the private sphere, or the sphere marked as private, these women, whom I consider to be fighters, have a broad understanding of violence that goes beyond this sphere considered as private, and also consider war and war-induced vulnerabilities faced by women as violence, as gendered violence. The moderates, the second category, they pursue a double strategy of, on one hand, acknowledging that violence against women does exist, but then also at the same time keep under wraps that it is structural and systemic. So moderates do scandalize violence against women and argue that the perpetrator must be brought to justice, however, without addressing patriarchal relations and structures of gender, sexuality, and social reproduction that underlie gender-based violence in the first place. Instead, they single out cases of violence and frame them as isolated incidents and construct male perpetrators as, in quotation marks, villains and perverts. So they, in accordance with this, consistently avoid any vocabulary which would acknowledge the structural character of gender-based violence, such as patriarchy, gender inequality, or domination. And finally, deniers. The main characteristics of this group is that it denies gender-based violence exists as a distinct category of violence and argue instead that everybody can experience violence. Gender-based violence is considered to be a feminist conspiracy which turns women against men. And when they address issues of violence against women, they do so in order to strengthen the unity of the family and to save families from splitting, and not in order to challenge relations, patriarchal relations of violence. The fourth issue area that I identified among organized Muslim women is what I call the politics of family. Here, the activists or organized Muslim women claim to protect the Turkish Muslim family from degeneration. And they consider the Turkish Muslim family an archetype which must be defended against alleged attacks by feminists, by the LGBTQ plus community, and the West. Numerous interviewees in my sample were active in organizations which then again were members of a big umbrella organization called the Turkey Family Platform. They have been openly against the LGBTQ community and their political demands, and accuse them of damaging Turkish families and the well-being of children. In advance of the Pride Week 2020, a total of 122 conservative NGOs launched a joint declaration under the guidance of this umbrella organization that I just mentioned, Turkey Family Platform, or short TURAP, against what they call, I quote, the LGBT movement, which poses a threat to public health and to the continuation of generation. I think you will find this sort of politics of family similar, or you will maybe recognize parallels also to such forms of politics in Europe and elsewhere. And then finally, I would like to mention the politics of Islamic charity. Here, women engage in charitable work in order to save women and families for the sake of Allah. Here, they consider poverty as individual fate and draw on the Islamic tradition of almsgiving for its alleviation. And this actually articulates well with neoliberalism, and is a testament to the compatibility of Islamism with capitalism in Turkey, because here poverty is not considered as the outcome of structural inequalities in redistribution of social wealth, but considered as bad luck on an individual basis. And here demands are not directed, political demands are not directed towards the state or its institutions, but towards the Islamic community to give to the poor. Now, after this maybe not so brief overview to the of the issue areas that I had identified in my interviews with organized Muslim women, I would like to come to talk a little bit about what they mean, these issue areas, and the different positions organized women take while pursuing these issues, what it means for their relationships with one another. First of all, I think it shows convincingly that the category of the Muslim women's movement so it is difficult to uphold the category of Muslim women's movement empirically. And it also shows that a new attention needs to be paid to the conflicts between Muslim women. So they should not be considered as a unified or somehow homogeneous political bloc or front camp. But we should also consider the conflicts ongoing between these women, because they do tell us more about the political, broader political context of Turkey, and also the challenges, but also the opportunities women's movements may be facing therein. A main line of conflict that I identified was between those who defended gender equality and those who defended gender justice, and I also was not able to observe or didn't observe any crossings, that is, cooperation or alliances between these two camps. And the proponents of gender justice overall articulate well with the neoliberal and anti-feminist status forces and policies. Politics, and they do thus enjoy more recognition and political influence by the state and its institutions. Proponents of gender equality, on the other hand, they become increasingly isolated and marginalized in their own neighborhoods. So neighborhood, it's here used figuratively, like in political neighborhoods, or neighborhood thought as a political identity, or maybe the societal segment where one stems from. And now a few words on the coalitions that can, but very often cannot be built. Especially young feminist women who are active in women's and other, for example, feminist, secular feminist, Islamic, anti-capitalist, pro-Kurdish organizations and groups at once, seek to accommodate their intersectional needs and interests. I identified in my sample numerous activists whom I call commuters, because they keep crossing the borders between social movements and help them become more fluid. And I identified one bridge builder who is doing important political work to bring together different activists and make sure that exchange of information or information flow from one women's group to another one is maintained, especially between secular and Muslim women. This kind of activists, that is the commuters and the bridge builders, hold the biggest potential for social transformation. But this kind of intersectional politics, which considers the different structures of oppression and domination faced by different women, is at the same time very energy consuming. So the activists who do that can suffer from political intersectionality, where they feel like their political interests are marginalized by different groups that they are active in, or the different political groups that they are active in may contradict each other, thus leaving them in a vulnerable or precarious position. But they may also relate to this experience intersectional disempowerment, something that was supposed to be more empowering, you know, by paying attention to the interrelatedness of structures and systems of domination, they become disempowered. Conservative Muslim women, they display more unidimensional understandings of gender, violence, and poverty. They move in much smaller radius and are often confined to the conservative segments of the civil society. However, the capacity or the willingness of Muslim women either to build or not to build coalitions, I do not wish to think of it as some individual characteristic that some women display, but more think of political capacity and willingness against the background of the broader political context. That is, there are political factors and structures and processes and outcomes that impact and shape women's willingness and capacity to build or to wave coalitions. For example, a reform-friendly political atmosphere and lack of armed conflict has proved to be conducive to building women's coalitions. That has been the case during the peace-building process between the PKK and Turkey, but a remilitarization of the Kurdish issue and the overall nationalist and anti-feminist political atmosphere has proved to be or to have negative effects on building women's coalitions. I have written down a very good example that is illustrative of this, but looking at my watch, I feel like I should skip it at that point, and should there be a question, come up a question on this, I'm happy to elaborate. Also, I found in my sample that emotions of despair too can have a paralyzing effect on women who otherwise pursue intersectional politics and are in fact or potential coalition builders. So events or yeah, events, chains of bad events provoke feelings of despair. And some women feel disheartened or demotivated to pursue intersectional politics, which is, for example, also has been the case with a young activist that I had talked to, who was preparing to go on a research stay in a Kurdish city in Turkey, but felt like she was powerless and helpless in the face of the escalating political situation in Turkey in 2005. So here are some concluding thoughts. Of course, my research, I concluded my field work in 2016. A lot has happened since then, but I think everything that has happened actually added more to the crucial importance and growing difficulty of building women's coalitions. First of all, an increasingly authoritarian mode of governing has become norm in Turkey, and AKP has formed a reactionary nationalist, Islamist, and anti-feminist alliance, now joined by other Islamist parties. And also, we should consider the broader context beyond Turkey, that is, the rising anti-genderism in Europe and beyond. We should also consider that these movements do learn from each other, do borrow from each other, and that attacks against feminist movements and the LGBTQI community are ongoing elsewhere as well. So we should also maybe see the broader picture here. So here I'm convinced about the growing importance of building women's solidarities and coalitions. And actually in Turkey, we can observe a growing interest in loosely organized women's initiatives that demonstrate broad-based coalitions. Feminists, including Muslim feminists, who pursue intersectional politics can play an increasingly active role in fostering dialogue and solidarity among women, and thus contributing to the building of broad women's coalitions, even under challenging political circumstances. That, of course, requires a lot of hard political work, because, and here I would like to finish my talk with the words of Black feminist legal theorist Angela Harris, because bridges between women are built, not found. Thank you very much for your attention.